Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to the Kate Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. blogtalkradio.com/Kate Thompson Live. It's the way that you can get to the show directly. I am the son, also known as Eric Payne, and you are?
And I am the mother of Eric Payne. So, I just love that opening, you know. But Eric, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff in the news, so much news, I'm telling you. We are going to be talking to Larry Hand, who is a, he is a fighter, African-American issues all over the place, I'm telling you. And there's so much negative stuff going on because of the new president, and that's Donald Trump. So we're going to be talking to Larry Hamm, who is well-known in the community, about what his opinions are and what he thinks Black Lives Matter, for instance, but that they are making a real impact. And so that's what we're going to be doing. And I want to sort of touch on Donald Trump for a minute. I think it sounds to me, or it looks to me, like he's losing it, really, that he is going to be, we're going to be hearing soon that he is not going to be finishing out his, with presidency, because the fact that, you know, I really think that he might be losing it. He might be, you know, sick.
Okay. Like this week, we're talking about some of the stuff in the news.
Yeah.
This week, you know, Donald Trump. Let's go back a little bit. What the most immediate thing was, that's James Comey being on Capitol Hill today. on Capitol Hill. I mean, geographically, I don't know if the FBI is there, so forgive me if I might be miscalculating that. But being back, testifying before the Senate committee on the situation, and who really doesn't have, I think, in my perspective, my opinion now, Comey really doesn't have that much credibility, claiming that if he didn't tell the people about the reopening of the investigation into Hillary Clinton, it would have been worse than not telling it. And the loophole, the reason why he was able to bring it back up, or say the first time that Hillary Clinton, you know, come to that original conclusion that there was nothing really that she did wrong or intentionally wrong initially, that case was closed. They closed the investigation. And then some other people, in some further research, they found that Huma Abedin, Hillary's kind of right hand pretty much, was basically sending emails home to use the family printer, but sending it to Anthony Weiner's computer, emailing the documents and some classified documents to him, and they were pretty much, that's how they were doing it. But, you know, obviously it blowed out of proportion. And, of course, it was classified material, and strictly to go technically, you're not supposed to do that, right? So, come to find out, they're saying, you know, these guys, they reopened the investigation allegedly because they found the emails on Anthony Weiner's computer. That's when they dropped the bombshell. But then when they completed that investigation, they saw there was no intent.
Yeah.
So now what they're going to do, it's the same outcome. You see, well, there was no nefarious intent like the Republicans are trying. So his rationale to say, I had to say something because it would have been worse not to say something, and it turned out we still had the investigation ongoing, and then it turns out that it was initially the same conclusion that your in investigation was before when you first closed it, and to not say anything that Donald Trump is being investigated is that doesn't hold with me. That doesn't wash. Let me bring in, and that's just the we'll get into Trump the historian after that. I want to bring in our co-host, Wayne Gilman. Wayne,
hey,
how you doing?
Good evening,
hey,
folks.
Wayne Gilman,
now,
legendary newsman. How are you?
All right, and yourself?
Doing good,
good
doing
good. Good.
Did you get a chance to see a little bit of the, we're
Comey interview
with Comey situation, and how?
And the thing is, to me it was very lopsided, and I think Hillary stood her ground yesterday with regard admitting that there were some errors, and I also felt, I mean, I loved the Clintons and all that, but I really felt that that move on the tarmac would have raised questions anyway. I think Bill was not thinking clearly when he did that at that particular time. But I also think it was somewhat disingenuous that nothing came out about Trump's investigation with respect to what was going on. And it just seemed very lopsided, you know? And
it seemed like a lot of poppycock to me. And
really.
To quote a great semi-great American. Let's bring our resident historian in, Byron Saunders. Byron, I'm sure you caught my phrase that I used, poppycock, and you me saying that Comey's reasoning was poppycock. And I know you, as the historian, can give us some insight as to who actually used that phrase poppycock in referring to what people have said about him.
Thank you.
Hi, Byron.
Good evening, my friends. You know, it's like very interesting indeed that what's going on up on Capitol Hill with respect to the senatorial hearings into the all of this poppycock. Okay.
So, Byron, you're our historian. Now, do you know who used that phrase? I mean,
poppycock, and the definition of poppycock, according to Merriam-Webster, is nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
right.
It's fine for English
right.
language learners. As to who officially used it, well, say it was, for instance, the cherry tree. I mean, I'm looking stuff up here, and it's giving me some interesting analogy.
I'm going to talk about more modern America. I say a semi-great American, not really nefarious, and I'm going to keep it presidential. He's a president.
Okay.
And he was a president.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say.
Wayne, you know what I'm talking about?
I want to say, because I did hear that all the time, and I think it was either Nixon or Reagan, one of the two.
Exactly,
and,
Richard Nixon, when they were talking about
Richard
Nixon. Right.
Oh my goodness.
They were talking about
that
stuff. There was one particular interview, I believe it might have been 60 Minutes, and I got a good memory because that was a long time ago. I was about nine then. But,
yes, it was.
But I always remember that because they made a big thing because Nixon said, a lot of that is just poppycock. And people were like,
right.
Nixon says it's poppycock, you know. So I always remember that phrase from like 9 years, 40 years, whatever.
Because of the fact that when he said it, you said, ooh.
I remember that. Okay, well, I know you wasn't trying. I knew it was coming.
You know, I mean, to tell
a
lot.
That's a little bit of acting there, folks. The quote was
just plain poppycock, and it's summer of 73, somewhere back in there when Nixon was
on his way out.
Alexander Butterfield, but in that time frame, yes. So
that's what
I do remember because growing up in Washington,
Trump and his people and Comey certainly today, you know, his reasoning for talking about Hillary being investigated and not Trump, to me, is that's why I use that phrase. And Nixon is a perfect similarity to Trump, probably the closest, probably even worse than W. Bush. And I never thought I would long for the days of W. Bush to be president.
The one thing that's interesting about Comey's testimony is that in fact, he is a Republican. And therefore, calling into question his sincere, nauseous feeling that he claimed to have had. Please, that was about as close to poppycock as you can get.
You're changing it, Bill Byron.
But
I tell you, Byron.
Yes.
With all due respect, I mean, going back to the time of the actual investigation, even though Loretta Lynch was large and in charge, you know how, and I hate to even throw race in this, but, you know, I just couldn't understand why Bill made that move, you know? because, I mean, there was still a lot of speculation and conjecture as to what was going on. And half the time, a lot of these people out here didn't even understand what the whole email controversy was all about. You know? I mean, and then why give rise to speculation just because you want to share, you know, supposedly the conversation was all about families and personal and all that crap. But, you know, it just heightens intrigue. What do they really talk about?
Does.
You know?
Well, that was
I think that was a Clinton misstep, personally.
Right. Well, and the whole thing to me was that's the argument. If you remember from Benghazi hearings when Kevin McCarthy idiotically revealed that all their hearings on Benghazi and calling Hillary before that committee was about damaging her for her presidential run. And and the whole notion of that, what they were trying to establish, if you remember, is that her negligence in sharing these emails and her negligence in handling classified material was trying to say she was somehow derelict in her job. That's why she didn't get the emails from Christopher Stevens, the ambassador that got killed. So they were trying to draw a correlation that she was responsible for the deaths of these Americans in Benghazi, because they were saying she wasn't paying attention, didn't read the emails, didn't respond. That's the whole email track, right? And just the fact of that, which is a reach, right? And there's no evidence of that, but to me there's clearer, more solid evidence that Donald Trump is a criminal. Obviously, the man has lied in front of people on a daily basis throughout the campaign trail.
Oh.
So, and also was sued and had a judgment against him. So I don't know how it always bewildered me how, if you're saying two people are liars, right? One lies about I don't want to go back to Bill Clinton because that gets in a whole bunch of other stuff. But two people are liars, right? One lies about something little, like, did you pick up my pen or whatever or whatever. One lies about a murder. So between the two of them, which lie is greater, right? And if one of the lies you're trying to establish is not even a lie, and you're not even establishing it as having been a lie, which is the Benghazi theory, and the other one is clearly a murder, then, you know, clearly there's people in this country who side with murder, right? I mean, I don't want to get extreme because it's my mom's show on Eric Payne, Citizen Payne, Black Panther show. I might be making some other more extreme, but, you know. I mean, I'm talking about the eradication of a population, Native Americans and stuff like that. So some people are okay with
my
murder. And even Trump said, our president said, you know, when one reporter was asking him about Putin, he's a murderer, and Trump said, so what do you think? We're so innocent? We're not murderers? You remember that, right?
Exactly. Right.
So, I mean, in weighing out the two people and trying to say one is worse than the other, and they effectively turn it around, Hillary should be locked up. They got a whole thing. Try to create a whole history of her being a dishonest person. When this guy, Trump, we know that, living in this area, he's got a 30-year track record of being a dubious businessman. Sometimes, you know, great, you're a billionaire, but you also were known for sometimes pushing the edge, pushing the limits a little bit. That's why you know Putin so well. That's why you're over there and then turn around and try to lie about it. Go ahead, Ma.
Before we get into this really deeply, we're waiting for Larry Hamm, who is, you know, a person that's dealing with black issues and keeps us in check and involved with black issues. And he is an activist, and he's going to be calling in. So if you're listening, Larry, we are awaiting you. And later on in the show, we're going to be talking to Bill Getz. The YouTube war will go right ahead with this. I don't know. I'm waiting for you to talk about Trump and the appearance of Trump and what he seems like. He seems to me like he's losing it, okay? Really, he does not seem like he has his senses all together. Bingo.
Okay. Yeah, clearly, I mean, I agree with you. He's not a historian, right? Right, Byron? He's certainly not a historian.
No, he's not a historian.
we know
falls short. He falls short of that claim. Indeed, but I think you may have something about his mental capacity here, and it seems that he is failing in other areas, not just history, but if you noticed the passage of the budget, the $1.1 trillion budget, the only thing the Republicans got out of this of any significance
is the increase, and that was half of what they required for the budget defense. The rest of the bill, that's the $1.1 trillion bill, is not the Republican agenda. Most of this, if not 100% of it, is everything the Democrats wanted to keep going, including funding for the NEA and funding for public broadcasting and funding for National Institute of Health and Sciences. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is nothing in this package bill right now that should be touted as a Republican victory, period.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what they were trying to do. You see,
they would have you believe that.
That's right.
Exactly.
They're spinning another lie, which is basically fake news.
And this is the insanity. This is the insanity cycle that we're in, right? This guy is a liar.
Yes.
Has committed. And this is. I was just having this discussion before I came, and we set up things for the show tonight with one of my cousins who went to law school, a lawyer. He doesn't have a practicing lawyer anymore. And one of the issues that I have with the legal system, of course, we need a legal system, a way of the courts are administered and justice and things like that, right? But average people, when we go into a court of law, say you go in for an accident, a car accident, and two people are trying to sue each other, right? And it gets to trial. And one person has a lawyer and the other person doesn't. Because the other person says, well, I'll just go say the truth and say this. But, you know, the law allows, there's a certain way you have to speak in the courtroom, right? Certain things might be objected to. Certain things might be sustained. A lawyer can technically trip up a normal person who can clearly state their case. Most people, anyway, halfway intelligent, educated, can clearly state the facts. But if you don't present it in the right way in the court of law and you don't have a lawyer who knows how to present it in the correct way, you can technically get tripped up, right? And technically, your case can be thrown out, or people have gone to death row because they had, you know, public defenders that didn't really do their job. So the whole concept of circumstantial evidence, which clearly, in certain instances, you know that circumstance is going to lead up to this person being guilty, right? The only thing that's missing is a smoking gun. Trump's is hiding their whole situation. It just kind of irks me. Well, a lot more that irks me, that they're able to hide behind this man committed treason, okay? And it is circumstantial evidence, right, that he committed treason, because there's no direct correlation that he was down with Michael Flynn and Michael Flynn was working with Russia. But it sure seems like it, don't it? It sure seems like everybody, I'm using don't, I know my mom, the English teacher, is telling me doesn't. I'm using that as for an effect, Mom. But it sure seems like everybody around him and all of them, they're dealing with, there's sure a lot of kind of tentacles and threads reaching with you guys for it not to be, you know, no fire where there's all this smoke. So the legal system that allows for, and it's for good purpose, because obviously it usually is supposed to work to keep innocent people innocent, but we know unless you're black, where, hey, all you need is to
a double standard.
Have somebody make a notion or even a signal that you did something. But, hey, that's what it's supposed to be. But it just, I don't know how you guys feel, it just really kind of gets to me that this, we're playing this lie out, right? We're playing this lie out. And on top of that, this guy's an idiot. This guy's, you know, Trump, to me, I mean, he's got the intellect slightly smarter than a lottery winner. And I don't mean to disrespect lottery winners, but he seems to be one of the most unintelligent billionaires I've ever heard of. I don't get it.
Yeah, I said that is just awful, but he is the president of the country. So one must show him some respect. Actually, you don't really have to, because he doesn't show anybody else any respect, including
I was just
going to
say.
You don't have to say, okay? Yeah. As a matter of fact, the filth that came out of his mouth, you know, some time ago, I have absolutely no respect for him whatsoever. I cannot wait until he leaves office. Mm. And I think we do have someone else calling me in there. Larry Ham?
Yeah, let me see if this is Larry Ham.
Larry Ham is going to be...
Hello, caller. Good evening. It's Larry Ham, yes.
Very good.
Larry Ham, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm sorry I'm late for the program. I was the guest speaker tonight at the Essex County Education Association annual Human and Civil Rights Dinner. And I just want to give them a shout out. And I was the recipient also of the Human and Civil Rights Award for this year. So I had a hard time getting out. Thank you. I had a hard time getting out of there. Thanks. But it was a good time. It was a very lovely time. They were very, very nice to me tonight.
Well, Larry, you know, you deserve it. I'd like to tell Wayne Gilman, who is on the air with us, one of our partners, and
good
also
evening,
Byron
Larry.
Good evening,
and of course,
Wayne,
you know,
Gilman, the legendary Wayne Gilman.
Oh, my God. I owe you money, too, huh?
No. I used to hear you on that other station all the time, man.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, you know. It's time has gone by so quickly, but I'm glad to still be here. I don't want to repeat a story I said last week about internet radio, but I'm behind my times because of the vehicles that I drive. But I know that we're out there, and we sound just as loud and as clear as we did back in the day.
That's right. Kay Payne is on top of the technology, brother. She's dragging
and
screaming into the 21st century.
And she looks way better than I. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Wayne, I'm going to get you. Listen, Larry, great technology. If you're not careful, I will send you to the moon with this new technology. But listen, Larry, you are. I don't know what I'm doing with this technology. That's why Eric keeps me right in line. You know, he knows it all. I'm telling you, People's Organization for Progress. Congratulations, and how are you doing with that organization and what it's doing? You've been keeping us up to date on the lives of Black America in Newark, and you've been standing out. Well, you tell us.
Well,
POP
has, yes, we've been trying to keep up our activism on issues that are important to our community. We just marched for jobs and justice and protection for immigrant brothers and sisters on May Day, and we will be May Day was May 1st. And Kay, I don't know if you remember or not, but when I was a kid, we used to celebrate May Day in school. They would take us. I went to South 17th Street School, and on May 1st every year we would go to the park, which was right across the street, West Side Park. We'd have a half day of classes and a half day of play for May Day. But I don't think that's right. I don't think they do the May Day anymore. But May Day is returning in the United States as a major day of protests. There were May Day protests all over the country on Monday. And a lot of people don't know that the origins of May Day are right here in the United States. It began with workers who were on strike, Chicago, and they were striking for the eight-hour workday. And their slogan was 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, and 8 hours of recreation. And so a lot of people don't know that human beings had to fight for the eight-hour workday, that this was not something given to people. This was something that we fought for, you know. And Black people, believe it or not, that's a part of it that's not often talked about, but there were Black workers who were in those original May Day demonstrations, just like Memorial Day, which is coming up, right?
Yeah.
Memorial Day. A lot of people don't know the origins of Memorial Day have to do with Black folks who were honoring their family members who fought in the Civil War, the Black soldiers that fought in the Civil War, who were honored when they returned home. Because, you know, people don't know, back in the day, Black soldiers and white soldiers couldn't even be buried in the same cemetery.
Exactly.
There's a community in New Jersey called Pennington, Pennington, New Jersey. It's a town between Princeton and Trenton. And in Pennington, they have an African burial ground. And it's always been called that from the beginning. The Black people in the 19th century, the Black people in that town, got their little pennies together, and they purchased land to bury their family members who had fought in the Civil War because they couldn't be buried in the white cemetery. And you can go there and see the headstones, the original headstones with the writing on them so that you would know what these men did, the role that they played in the army, you know, cavalry, infantry, cannon master, et cetera. I've been there several times, and I've seen this with my own eyes. But I digress. Let me just say that we were protesting for May Day, and this Monday we will have our 67th consecutive Justice Monday.
Wow.
Justice Monday, okay. Yes. Justice Monday is every Monday the People's Organization for Progress and supporters, we go to the federal building in Newark at 970 Broad Street, and we protest from 4:30 to 6 o'clock every Monday for victims of police brutality here in New Jersey and around the country. And the four cases that we've been highlighting in New Jersey are Abdul Kamal, who was killed. He had a cell phone in his hand when he was shot 15 times by Irvington police. Jerome Reed, who was shot at point-blank range. His killing is on video. The video went viral. He's the fellow that was down in Bridgeton, New Jersey, that got out of the car with his hands up. He was shot 7 times by Officer Brahim Days in Bridgeton. Kashad Ashford, who was killed by police in Lyndhurst, New Jersey, and Radaz Hearns, who was shot 7 times in the back, 14 years old, shot 7 times in the back by police in Trenton. He survived, miraculously, that shooting. But we've been demanding that the U.S. attorney launch civil rights investigations into the deaths of these young men. And this Monday, we will add to that group Alton Sterling. And just today, Alton Sterling was a young man that was killed in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, by police. The Justice Department ruled today that they would not pursue charges against those officers. It's now in the hands of the Attorney General of the state of Louisiana. And we're also going to add Jordan Edwards. He's the 15-year-old that was shot in Texas, shot in the head. And he was leaving a house party, and he was shot. He was sitting in the car when he was shot with a rifle, no less. I believe it was a rifle or a shotgun by police in Texas. So that's what we'll be doing on Monday.
You know, this is so astounding, Larry. I mean, just to hear these names and some of the cases I'm familiar with, and then there are others that I'm not, and it just sickens me to think that here in 2017, and given the political climate in Washington, that we're still dealing with this issue.
Well, we've been dealing with it for a long time. If you go back to the first issues of the Crisis magazine, which Dr. Du Bois helped to publish, they were talking about police brutality, turn of the century. And if you, you come on up, you know, to the 60s, Mary Baraka was one of the first to raise, and Bob Kervin raised the demand for a police review board in Newark after a shooting death in 1966, I believe it was. Yes, it's terrible, but we're going to continue to have this problem as long as we have police forces that are made up primarily of people who don't live in the communities that they police and who don't even reflect ethnically or racially the people they police. And if it's not the patrolmen themselves that don't reflect this, the supervisory staff, continues to be majority white of most of these police forces around the country. So the police behave like an occupying military force in our community. And it's going to take some doing to turn it around.
Mr. Larry Hamm, Eric Payne.
Eric,
my
how
father
you doing,
said, all right, how are you?
All right.
I never had a chance to really talk to you at length as I'm listening to you now. My father told me about you a number of years ago. I don't know how long 67 active Mondays. How many years is that?
That's 1 year and about 2 months. 1 year and 2 months.
Right.
67 consecutive Mondays we've been out there. we've been joined from time to time by the mothers of the young men that were killed. In fact, the most consistent attendee is the mother of Jerome Reed, Shayla Reed, and the stepfather, Munir Muhammad. They've been there almost every Monday. She won't be there this Monday, though, because she had a kidney transplant operation last night. So she's in recuperation. But, you know, it's a tragedy. You know, we had a shooting in Newark, too. And I know that there's one story in the paper. This was a shooting that occurred earlier last week. I believe the young man's name was Hakeem McNair, who was shot to death. Now the newspaper version story saying he had a gun. But I recently was contacted by that family. In fact, 2 days ago I was contacted by them. They have a different story, and they're coming to our meeting. The People's Organization for Progress, we meet every Thursday at 6:30 at the Abyssinian Baptist Church, 224 West Kinney Street in Newark. And they're coming to the meeting on Thursday to tell their version of the story. And also, Kay, we're going to have, and Eric and Wayne, we're going to have Jim Johnson, who I believe is the only black candidate running for governor. He's going to be at our meeting on Thursday night also. We have had just about all of the major Democratic Party candidates now, with Nesty, Murphy, Lesniak, and now Johnson is coming through to address our organization. We put together a black agenda, we call it, of issues that we've asked all the candidates their positions on, so we'll be asking Mr. Johnson that when he comes on Thursday, in addition to this issue of police brutality.
In terms of that, you know, obviously, like, we went back to Dr. Du Bois and the history of our people in this country. Is at one time the police were supposed to, you know, the slave catchers, right? That was, I guess, one of the early police forces. And
yes.
I just am wondering, as a kind of a tactical or kind of across the board, just kind of a whole mission, you know, how do we get black law enforcement involved in demanding within their ranks of the unions, police fraternal unions, which we know are predominantly white or if not all white, certainly the hierarchy and people I think that really make the agenda. That's one thing I think I want to ask you about. Should that be addressed, as well as there being consequences for these cops that do these things? I mean, the Justice Department, justice system, seems to be run by people who are like-minded, if not, you know, conspirators with these people and this perspective, how they view African American authorities. And so
I think it's,
you know, no, go ahead. That was my question.
No, I think it's very important what you just said. I think it is important for black officers to speak out and to speak out within their union organizations. I know in a number of cities the black officers have had black patrolmen's organizations or black law enforcement organizations, and some of them have been very progressive, like the 100 black, I forgot the name of it. It's the 100 Black Men in Law Enforcement, I think.
The one in New York?
Yes, Wayne.
Right.
Group.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They've been around, and they have been active.
Right. And
I know there's also Noble, too.
That's right, Noble. And in Newark, they had the Bronze Shields. I don't know how active they are right now, but at one time they were active. If the Black Law Enforcement Office, because now, whereas at one point, say in the 60s and 70s, the number of black officers were small comparatively on these police forces. Now, I mean, I think Newark, when you add minority officers all together, black, Latino, Asian, I think they're actually over 50% now in terms of patrol people. The supervisory line is another discussion. I think they need work there. But I'm just saying that it's important for the black officers to organize and where they have these associations to participate in them and to use them as platforms to raise these issues, you know, because, you know, as quiet as it's kept, black officers have issues too. I mean, every year it seems that an undercover black officer is killed by white police officers. Now, he's a police officer. He's doing police work, and he's shot by white police officers. We've had several.
Friendly fire.
Yeah, that's what they call it, friendly.
I mean, I don't mean to laugh, but I mean, I just think it's despicable. Go ahead, Kay, sorry.
I want to mention that when I was on WLIB, and Wayne, you remember this quite well, I did do a segment called Police Reports with Ali Al-Rahman, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we covered a lot of these cases, you know, and I remember getting so furious every time somebody white kills somebody black from the police department. They should have known better, and it kept me in such a state of mind of fury that I could barely even talk on the air like, you know, it's getting now. I don't know where Barney is. I want to hear about it. But, Larry, you are to be so commended. You have been out there every single day. You know, every single Monday?
It's every Monday, every Monday.
Monday.
For over a year.
Yeah, and doing exactly the same thing that a lot of people should be joining you to do. So I commend you, and I want you to know that a lot of people, you know, really think so highly of you.
Yeah, I was just talking about that to my mom the other day, that the police report that she used to do is something that really, you know, I'd like to see done again in the community. And you know, Larry Hamm, Mr. Hamm, my father, as I said, my father told me about you, but both my mother and my father told me that you are a great man. Because,
well, I'm trying to be like your dad. I'm trying to be like him, actually. he's a legend. He's a legend in his own right, sponsor of the Amistad Act. And, you know, your dad's one of the few people I know that actually didn't just meet but interacted with Martin Luther King and with Malcolm X.
Mm. Right. What I noticed, well, what I've grown up around men like yourself, Amiri Baraka, and just happened to be born in this life in the city of Newark, is that, you know, the consistency, the ever pushing, you know, it's, you know, around the 80s, you know, when things started to get a little bit better for black people, some people dropped out of the movement, right? Some people stopped pushing because life became
That's true.
Healthy. And
that's
always an easy thing to do. And for a myriad of reasons, some of our people get tired of fighting, and I would never, you know, except for certain people, I would never point a finger and say some people weren't doing their part or being sellouts. And I say I like to have that exception for certain people, because there are some that think just join the other side. But it's the consistency that the next generation sees is what is the point I'm trying to make. That's what I saw as a young man coming up, is the consistency of a commitment to the struggle of our people. I mean, if the civil rights, if each generation didn't act, there was no one else to act. I see the history saying, people saying, if we don't do this, who is going to do this? If we don't pass on this legacy, who is going to pass it on? You know, coming to that age where you start to realize certain things, you realize that certain responsibilities fall on you as a people, and that's what the younger generation notices about people like yourself and other people that have helped, that have pushed the struggle along, the consistency. And perhaps what I'm saying is we need to expand that truth, the roots of those trees. Plant more trees, get more roots, but it produces more
fruit.
Right. That's what you do. And, you know, and as people hear about you, as I'm told about you, more people talk about, there's a gentleman that lives in my building that comes to all of your, I think he's down every Monday with you. Brother named Doug, elderly.
Yes, Douglas Tucker. Yes.
Wears glasses. That's right. He lives in my building, and he's always got his pop shirt on, and he's down there with you. So that's what I'm talking about. You know, the effect and the, you know, infecting people with that enthusiasm. Mm. So I couldn't get a
better testimony than that, brother. Thank you. Thank you.
Byron, what happened to Byron Saunders? I know he wanted to get
still here. I'm paying attention. I'm listening, taking notes, taking copious notes. But I will say that with respect to Brother Ham's commitment to the civil rights movement and the struggle, it continues every single day. And with you, like people like yourself, and one of my mentors, C.T. Vivian, and Hosea Williams were my mentors,
working
with SCLC. So, you know, we get off the sidelines. We get off our butts off the couch and get into the streets and talk to the people and continue to bring them forward. Your organization is just another stop on the Underground Railroad, on the way to freedom.
There you go.
And it must continue. So I salute you and what you're doing and support every effort. So we walk in faith and we walk together as brothers on the shield.
That's right.
You know,
right. Thank you.
I don't know where I saw this saying, but it said something like, we've done so much with so little for so long, we're not qualified to do anything with nothing. And
wow.
That's so often.
Yes. Wow. That's profound.
About struggle. And let me just ask you, how do you think this new technology has helped to get the word out and to exchange ideas and just to move things forward? Obviously.
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword, and it's interesting that you raise this because I was actually having this discussion with someone earlier this week. I can remember when the Arab Spring broke out and you had these massive uprisings, political uprisings, in a number of the Arab countries, and the media was pointing out how the people use social media to communicate and to organize. And I said, oh, this is great. I was one of these dinosaurs. I wasn't on Facebook till about a year ago. You know, I think I got on Facebook. Yeah, no, really. The end of 2015, I think I got on Facebook, right? And so I
don't feel shame.
Don't feel bad, Larry.
Right. And so, you know, I began to use it, and it does help get the word out to people. There's no doubt about it. But what it doesn't actually do is move people. You know, in a way, the social media is like a newspaper. It informs people. It tells people what's going on. But you still need something after the people get the news that will actually push them to action. I was speaking on a college campus. I was speaking at Livingston College around the same time, and I was saying to the students, right, be like the young people in the Arab Spring. Use the Facebook to organize on your campus and to mobilize on your campus. So a number of them greeted me after my talk, and they said, Mr. Ham, you know, we understand what you were saying about social media, but our experience is that it's social media that's actually what's keeping them from being active. And I asked them to explain that. They said, well, people go in their rooms, they get on their computer or they get on their phones, and they don't come back out. They've created a kind of virtual world for themselves, you know, to meet people and to have friends and to have conversations. And they're in their rooms for hours and hours, and we can't get them to come out and stuff. So that tells me that, you know, it really depends upon the conditions that exist in a given situation. For the folks in the Arab countries where they had censored media and state-controlled mass media, the social media was a useful alternative. But the effect here may be different in the United States where we have an overload of media. It is a useful way because I'll give you an example real quick. I was driving up the turnpike night before last. My third daughter is a student at Rutgers, and I was taking her back, and I was coming back. And I went through the toll booth, and I had to use the one where you got to pay the money. And the toll guy looked at me, and he said, you're Larry Ham, aren't you? I said, yeah. He said, I see you all over the Internet. So that kind of tells me, right? That kind of tells me that it's useful in terms of getting the word out, but you still need some type of interlocutor between the social media and the people that will actually move the people to action.
Yes, sir.
And that's
I happen to agree with you, Larry. I mean, not to cut you off, but I've mm-hmm. seen so much of this, and I've seen where social media, well, literally killed traditional media up to maybe 10, 15 years ago. It was beginning, you know, it hit the newspaper
right.
people first, then it hit people
right.
a little bit on TV, and then, you know, radio eventually went dark in certain areas. And I still made traditional radio, that is terrestrial radio. And when
right.
you see what goes on today, it transcends just about social media with respect to it. I guess what I want to say, it just sort of weakens and it just lulls people into a level of complacency, because it's a source that they can go to, feel like they're in touch. But the motivational thing that we used to, you know, listen to an oratory appearance on somebody's
right.
radio station about a different event that's coming up, or just
right.
discussing the issues, how we are interacting with each other now. We don't
right.
have enough of that, and the platform is so sophisticated because, again, unless we are drawn to Kay Thompson Live, how are we to know, you know, that this show is out there other than
right.
the publicity that it generates? So,
right.
I mean,
well,
the thing is... I'm sorry, but I guess my point is just that it's not just with the movement that we're going through, but it's just about every aspect of life
right.
that social media just lulls you into this sense of complacency sometimes.
Well, there's so much content. It's like Mr. Hamm said, it's almost over media. There's so much content, so much competition, so many distractions, you know, if
yeah.
you're talking about, you know, talking about this, people forget that you committed treason, you know, and you start talking about wacky stuff. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's the analogy there. Also, too, with, like you were saying, there's people in their rooms, and so their action, their being active in the movement goes no further than them clicking the mouse and clicking on a like on your page
right.
on Facebook, forwarding
right.
an email from one of, you know, Color of Change or one of these other organizations, your organization also. So, just like you said, you have to get something else to move them to act, come out of your house and get in those streets. And the whole,
that's right.
It's like the women's movement march that happened after this guy stole the election. And, you know, I was at a function. I went with with my cousin, and we were speaking on a panel about women being involved in this march and this movement. And this one sister got up and said, well, you know, 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Said like 90-some-odd
right.
percent of African-Americans want to vote for Hillary Clinton. So she said, I almost want to tell y'all, get your people. No.
Right.
And,
right.
And that's really, you know, moving people to action, but it's like your action is too late. And well, let me ask you, how do you think, what's your perspective? I kind of know, and maybe it's a silly question, but of the Black Lives Movement in terms of their, I mean, they used it very effectively, social media.
Yes, they did. They created the Black Lives Matter hashtag and took off like fire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I want to say anything that gets our young black people in motion in a positive way, I'm for it.
Right.
You know, even if I don't know what it is at the moment, as long as we come get these young people to do something positive and engage in direct action in the struggle for human and civil rights, I'm for it. So I am supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement. And there's a Black Lives Matter group. There are a couple of them around in our New Jersey area. There's one on the Rutgers campus. And they're mostly college-based. And with the college students, and I think they're good, and I think they're making a meaningful contribution. I will say this, though, and this is in no way to detract from their great work, but I was somewhat concerned when in the middle, the Black Lives Matter movement, its roots actually go back to Trayvon Martin. I believe that's where the slogan started, Black Lives Matter. And from there, it became a movement as the police brutality, the egregious incidents continued to happen. You know, it caught fire, and, you know, all around the country. And the social media facilitated that, because with that hashtag, that you can go international, you know, once you had that hashtag. So I was glad to see the young people in motion, but I was kind of concerned about the slogan Black Lives Matter, because up to that point, people were saying stop police brutality. And then when we started saying Black Lives Matter, I understood the existential meaning of that phrase, but I actually thought it kind of took away from the impact of the agitation around the issue of police brutality, because look how many times we say Black Lives Matter when we could be saying stop police brutality. So every time we say Black Lives Matter, we're not saying stop police brutality. So in a way, it kind of took the focus off of the police and actually put the focus on a more broader discussion about what's happening to black people, when what was actually driving the Black Lives Matter movement was police brutality. And so in the People's Organization for Progress, we still say, for the most part, we say stop police brutality in the black community. You know, that's still the issue, you know, but we don't tell people not to say Black Lives Matter. We're not in contradiction. We're just trying to keep the focus on the police, because the police are going to be one of the hardest institutions to reform. They are both a paramilitary force and they're a political force at the same time. I mean, one of the best examples of this was the recent election of Donald Trump. Look at how simply the formula went. The fraternal, the 338,000 member Fraternal Order of Police endorses Donald Trump, along with the Ku Klux Klan, by the way. They endorse Donald Trump. Trump gets elected. Who does he appoint to head? Who does he appoint to be the U.S. Attorney General? Jeff Sessions, who was so bad that Coretta Scott King campaigned against him. He becomes the head of the Justice Department, and what is the first thing he says? The first thing he says is that we're going to back away from monitoring local police forces. That was a signal to these racist cops all around the country that they don't have to worry now, because Jeff Sessions' Justice Department is not going to be aggressively investigating these police brutality incidents like Loretta Lynch was when she had control, when she had leadership of the Justice Department. So you see how it works? Trump get elected.
And they just gave him permission to do other things also.
That's right. That's right. And today, the Justice Department announces that it's not going to file charges against the police that killed Alton Sterling.
And
that's a direct consequence of Jeff Sessions being in control.
And when asked about it in the press conference, the press briefing, Sean Spicer said the president agrees, the president supports states' rights. So, you know, that all of those things thrown in together pretty much tells you where we stand with Andrew Jackson. So
that's right. His hero is Andrew Jackson, a slave master who was not just a slave master. He was pro-slavery. He was a slave. He was about the business of hunting runaway slaves, and he was an Indian killer. It was Andrew Jackson who said the only good Indian is a dead Indian. That's his hero, you know. And he's talking about states' rights. That's what Bilbo and these other arch segregationists were saying when Dr. King was trying to struggle for civil rights. So, you know, we're in a political state. This is why I get so peeved with people who are in our community who are still, and I understand our people's frustration. I understand to a degree why they're so downhearted and depressed, but we got to fight.
We can't afford
that things can't change, that voting doesn't count, my vote don't count.
look, if the people, the votes that Hillary Clinton did not, she only lost in three states. The only three states where she gained the 70 votes, the 70 electoral votes. She didn't lose the popular vote. She only lost the electoral vote. The black people in Philadelphia alone, had they come out like they came out for Obama or even close to it, they could have made up the difference. And we wouldn't have Trump in there. I ran into some crazy black people talking about they voting for Trump. Well, now you've got Trump. And now you've got Gorsuch. And now you've got Sessions. And now you've got DeVos. This is what you wanted? This was your idea of what it means to be in the Republican Party? Come on. I'm sorry.
I agree. I'm telling you have to preach this because there's so many of us out there that are like that. You know, I don't know if it's an act of self-hate, you know, or I don't want to think that we're all that ignorant, but it's unfortunate that there is a vacuum. And again, I still go back to media. There's not enough of what we're doing here being exposed
right.
the way it used
right.
to be. And that's why
right.
we are lulled into complacency and silence and just going along with the program. As one black
that's
man
right.
told me just before the election, well, you know, maybe we should give Trump a chance because Obama couldn't get anything done. You know, not understanding the dynamic as to why, you know. And this guy that we have as president is already forecasting that maybe shutting down the government in 6 months' time is going to be a good thing. But then again,
good
he
Lord.
Still thinks Frederick Douglass is alive. So
yeah, man, and his best friend was Pavarotti.
Yeah,
been dead for 10 years.
I mean, we're talking about a guy who's BFFs with Count Putin, who wants to sit down and be honored to sit down with Kim Jong Un, and who's the other dictator? The Turkish dictator. I mean, so.
Erdogan,
he wants to be he pretty much wants to be a dictator, right? And I've been
yeah,
saying
yeah,
this
and he's,
been,
and he's about, been dictating for the last 100 days. He's been governing by executive order, which is a form
exactly.
of dictation. He's issued more executive the last 100 days than any other president. But you know, for the next 4 years. Our people need to engage in massive voter registration, and we need to engage in a campaign to get people to vote and not to sit home and not to think it doesn't count. Massive
yeah.
voter registration and mass voter education. We need both
right.
of those because this guy is talking about Trump is already – he's already campaigning for his second term. That's what these rallies are all about.
Exactly.
And he's telling people when I get my second term, you know, he's saying 8 years of Trump. I've actually heard him say this. This is not a speculation.
Yeah.
Right.
He's planning to be there 2 terms.
That's right. Two
go ahead.
Terms.
I'm sorry.
So, Larry Ham, we got to go. Our time is up. And we've had such a great discussion this evening. Time has flown
right.
by, and it's been a pleasure and an honor to speak to you. Thanks for calling in and giving us your time. We'll
all
do
right.
it, definitely
thank you
do it
for
again.
Having me. All right.
All right, Larry. Thank you very much.
It.
Thank you, Wayne.
All
thank
the best to you,
Simon.
Larry.
Take
all
care.
Right. Good night.
Peace and love.
All right. Mr. Wayne Gilman, take care. You want to sign out there?
Same to you, everyone. You know, it's been an enjoyable evening, and we'll stay tuned for next week's program.
All right.
Peace and love,
all right.
always.
All right. Take care, Mr. Byron Saunders. My name is Eric Payne. This is the K. Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You can always catch us, blogtalkradio.com/K. Thompson Live.
Every Wednesday at 8 to 9 p.m.
Yep.
And
also archived. You can listen to all the shows on the archive
absolutely.
As well.
You can hear them all.
Yep.
We're archived.
That's
every
right.
Every single one of them.
You are K. Thompson. You are K. Thompson. Go ahead. All right. That's K. Thompson. I'm Eric Payne, also known as Citizen Payne, also known as the Sun. Sorry, folks. Off the air. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye now.
Oh,
Thank you.